Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier- und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, this week coming to you from the Hay Festival in Hay. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with three other QI elves. It's Anna Chizinski, James Harkin, and Andy Murray. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with you, Chizinski.
Yes, did you mention that these are specifically literary facts?
Absolutely.
You did mention that. Checking. Yeah, because it's a literary festival.
Right? Yeah.
And that's why I said it.
Yeah. That's why I thought you said it. So my literary fact is that the first ever novel ended mid-sentence. And this is a Japanese novel called The Tale of Genji. It was written in the early 11th century, so probably 1008, they think. And, yeah, ended in the middle of a sentence.
Was it like a cliffhanger ending?
Kind of. I mean, not as melodramatic, but a character's introducing another character to someone, and it ends saying, Karu introduces him to the... You never find out who. Oh. And people don't know if that was intentional or if she just died in the middle of gave up or got bored or whatever. I think most critics think that it was intentional.
I heard another version, which is like she just carried on. She was going to carry on until she couldn't do it anymore. Because it is quite a long book, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's about 1,100 pages.
Yeah, 1,100 pages.
Yeah.
Apparently there's like 400 characters in there.
Yeah, and none of them have names.
No, none of them have names. And I read in one place... How do you do that, though?
Well, yeah, it must have been so confusing. So there are 400 characters, and apparently at the time it was rude in Japanese... It's all about Japanese aristocratic society in the 12th century, and it was rude to refer to someone by name because it was thought as being, like, unnecessarily familiar. So if there are 400 characters, none of them are allowed to be referred to by name, so they're all like, Your Excellency, Your Majesty, His Highness.
Oh, so they still had titles. Okay.
Yeah, but, I mean, there are 75 His Highnesses.
So I saw it, people like, oh, what's he doing here, said him. She knew what he meant about him.
That's a very cool way to end it. I like it.
Yeah, it is. So she's a bit like a precursor to Tristram Shandy. She seemed to have interesting things she did with the form of the novel.
The form of the novel, which she had just invented.
It's a really bold new kind of novel, actually.
So she defied the convention that she created 400 pages earlier. There's one bit, so two-thirds of the way through she kills off the main character about whom the whole thing is written, the tale of Genji, just dies. And also, it doesn't really explain that he's been killed off, it's just that there's a blank chapter called Vanished into the Clouds with no text in it, and then in the next chapter it becomes apparent that the protagonist has died.
Wow.
Yeah.
Does anyone know what the first e-book was?
No.
That's a thing where it's like there's a few different claims, but probably the most likely, it was a book called Uncle Roger by Judy Malloy. And you can still see it online. It's like all hyperlinked. And you go in there and it's like there's been a party and it has all the characters. You can click on a character and it gives you their little story and then you click on the next character and you do that. It's like, choose your own adventure books, those things that they used to have. They were amazing, those books, weren't they?
Yeah, so good.
And so... reading that this was like Choose Your Own Adventure, I thought I'd look into those. And apparently you can get adults Choose Your Own Adventure books.
Oh, God.
Yeah. The two bestsellers that I could find are called Beer, Women, and Bad Decisions.
That's great.
Sounds good, though, doesn't it? It sounds like you're going to try and get the bad decisions, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's like another pint or a prostitute tonight. Is that how it works?
That's how most nights work. And the other best-selling one I found is called Night of a Thousand Boyfriends.
Knight with a K, or...
That'll do.
So the first novel in the English language is obviously a different thing because the Tale of Genji is not in English. People often say it's Thomas Malory's La Morte d'Arthur, okay, which I like the idea that the first novel written in English has a French title. So I think it's actually this novel written in 1561 called Beware the Cat, which is, I think, the main contender for first novel written in English. It's just by a printer's assistant called William Baldwin. It's kind of a horror novel about, like, evil cats, really. It's about this, so this guy eavesdrops on a cat, and he overhears a female cat on trial. And the female cat's called Mouse Slayer, for obvious reasons. And she's having to explain to this court of other cats that she hasn't broken the cat's code of sexual conduct, which dictates that a female cat is not allowed to say no to any fewer than 10 male cats a night. So if you reject, you know, the 10th guy, you're up in court on trial. Anyway, his overhears this. At another point in this story, this first novel ever written, a priest slips on a cat and falls into a crowd.
Wait. Does he slip on a hat, or does he slip on a hat?
A cat!
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Andy's going to be Googling a book called Beware the Hat later. Oh, wait.
What can these guys do?
Hats on trial.
This priest does slip on it, and he ends up with his face in the bare arse of a boy who, out of fear...
What kind of an excuse is that? I slipped on a cat.
They were the 15th century equivalent of banana skins. Ends up with his face in the bare arse of a boy who, out of fear, had beshit himself. First novel.
Wow.
That's the first novel?
First novel in English.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I was seeing what was happening in Europe at the same time as this book was being written, this Japanese one. And in 1008, Bishop Burchard of Worms was writing books on canon law, a book that he called Corrector et Medicus. And the idea was he would give it to the bishops and give it to the priests, and it would give them the rules of the penance that they would give out to people. So if you did something wrong, it would be like 5 Hail Marys or whatever. Mm-hmm. But quite a lot of it seems to be very strange. One of the things was if a woman had smothered a live fish inside her vagina and then served it to men...
A classic prank. I really got him with the old vagina fish tonight. He won't put cling film under my toilet again.
Either that or kneading bread on her naked buttocks, then she would get a penance of 2 to 5 years fasting on feast days, according to this book.
So we were on endings of books earlier.
Yeah.
So the first version of Hamlet has a happy ending, which is nice. And it's called Amleth, which is Hamlet with the H at the other end. That's the sole change. You just move
was
the
that
H.
Some kind of, like, copyright law?
Bad news, William. We can't do anything with Amleth. Wait a minute.
A genius.
And it's the same. And it's right down to stabbing someone who's hiding behind an arras, all of that stuff. But then, at the end of it, he kills the usurper, so his father's brother, his uncle, kills the usurper, goes to England, marries the sexy Queen of Scots, returns with an army, and then becomes king. And then he has two queens. One is his wife and one is his mother, who was queen before.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how it ends originally.
I think they should redo it like that.
Do we have it, or we've just heard that it exists?
I don't know.
Just about authors who sort of came up with something and then flipped it into something else. Do you know how Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas started? Hunter S. Thompson's book? It was meant to be, and this is what he handed in when he handed in the majority of the book. It was actually originally meant to be a 250-word photo caption for Sports Illustrated. They wanted him to go cover a derby, and he started writing, and they were like, it's great, but
We kind of needed a fit in here.
Can you say the same stuff, but in there? Yeah. Wow, yeah. That's amazing.
Well, so they said, bad news, we can't put that below as a caption, so we've had to just give you a book deal instead.
No, 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 they didn't like it at all, and he had to take it elsewhere and get
it. Of course
it
they didn't like it at all. Read the Mail Online articles, and there's a one-line description of the photo, you know, so-and-so turned up at a party looking nice. You don't want a 60,000-word novel there.
Yeah.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Okay, why don't we move on to our second fact, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis went to a party dressed as polar bears. It was not a fancy dress party.
What? And then there's the added shame of turning up in the same thing as somebody else.
So Tolkien and Lewis, they were really good friends, of course. Go on.
Well, not always.
No, not always.
You'll probably get onto that in a few
seconds.
No,
please, go on.
Why Wait, sorry, do we know the circumstances of the fancy dress party? Or is that just a kind
no,
of thing?
No, not really. It seems to... I read it in a book. It was a biography of Tolkien, and it was like, here's one of the funny things that he used to do.
He so used to
tantalizing.
Yeah, I know.
But he used to like dressing up a lot.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he and not even when it wasn't a fancy dress party, just in day-to-day life.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Like he apparently very famously dressed up as an axe-wielding Anglo-Saxon warrior and chased his neighbor down the road.
So after they met for the very first time, C.S. Lewis wrote in his diary about Tolkien, "No harm in him, only needs a smack or so." So they did. They were very good friends for a long time, and then they had a rivalry later. Tolkien eventually they had meetings of a group called the Inklings, which is a sort of famous literary salon in a pub in Oxford, and they would read out their stuff to each other. And eventually, Tolkien didn't even go along to meetings when he knew that C.S. Lewis was going to read out Narnia stuff. That's how bad it got.
He really didn't like the allegory in Narnia, did he?
He said that writing an allegory, which Narnia, a lot of people say, is. And yeah, I think it is. he said that allegory was a very lazy form of writing, and he didn't really approve of it. So that's what it was.
One of the things that the Inklings did they would hold competitions to see who could read a particular lady's work without laughing. She was the worst writer
what?
In the world.
She Wait, was this a particular writer, or just did they find any woman author? Oh, right, because the way you said it, it just sounded like they were all massive sexists.
Yeah, it's true. It did sound like that.
It still sounds pretty sexist.
It does sound like that. So this lady was called Amanda McKittrick Ross. She wrote lots of fiction, and here's some examples of things that she said. She refers to eyes as globes of glare. She refers to legs as bony supports, and she refers to pants as southern necessity.
Okay. Well, that one's got assonance. The first one had alliteration. I mean, this is like ticking all the literary boxes, as far as I can tell.
Okay. She called sweat globules of liquid lava.
Lovely.
That's great.
This is a damn good simile.
Okay.
One of the main reason, in fact, I think the main reason actually that Tolkien objected to C.S. Lewis's allegory, and I just think this is quite interesting, it's not funny at all, but Tolkien was a strict Catholic, and he, when they started at the start of the 20th century, even in Catholic Mass, they would start saying that in English, he would say the Mass very loudly in Latin in the middle of church while they were saying it in English to make clear his thoughts. But he didn't object. So C.S. Lewis was an Anglican, so he didn't really believe that the word of God should only be spoken through like priests and members of the clergy, whereas Tolkien did. So Tolkien thought that it wasn't C.S. Lewis's place to be telling people about religion. Because he wasn't a member of the clergy. It was just, you know, it was quite interesting.
Also, Lewis nominated Tolkien for the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1961, and the committee rejected him. Oh. And they only recently have released the papers, which, because they have a sort of 50-year rule on the committee's decisions, and they rejected Tolkien, saying that he was a bad storyteller.
No.
Yep. They said the storytelling here is just not up to scratch.
Wow.
You know that Lord of the Rings, I don't know if this is really common knowledge, but the Beatles tried to option it to make it into a movie, and they approached Stanley Kubrick to make it. And
what?
I think everyone decided it was a bad idea. Once they all saw, that would have been amazing.
They were going to play all the characters, weren't they?
They were going to play all the characters. All we could have had the Beatles, Lord of the Rings. It would have been amazing.
I think I've read, there are so many theories about why it was rejected, and I don't even know why there needs to be a theory. It's quite obvious, but...
they were going to do it, and then they were like, no, he's such a terrible writer.
We love the Beatles. We love Kubrick and the Beatles, but, you know.
The Tolkien thing. I read one theory that it was because Paul and John were fighting over who got to play Gandalf. And,
no.
That was what tore it apart.
That's great. Some things on fancy dress.
Yeah.
While we're here. There's a lady called Sharni Christie who lives in Kent, and she has a phobia of people in costumes, which the newspaper article called metamphysomyophobia. And she works in theatre. So she said, people think it's quite funny that I'm working in something that means I'm around people in costume all the time. I have to watch people get dressed in costume in order to reassure myself that I know who they are. So she has to watch them get changed just so she knows it's not a...
That's Wait, a fantastic excuse for being a pervert, I must say.
Yeah. But also, so she's not only got a fear of people in costume, she suddenly... recognizes them as the character that they're playing.
Yeah, something
so
like
she's
that.
Like at the Lion King, she'll be like, hey, Mike, have it's a good a Simba.
Evacuate the theater.
There's a lion loose.
Is that the zoo?
It's me. Yes, me again.
Every night the same. Hello, London Zoo. There are a load of cats everywhere.
Do you say hats?
No, cats. I want to know when people started dressing as really crazy things, because they used to dress as aristocracy or people from different ancient Greeks. You would dress up as ancient Greeks or Trojans, and I think I've pinned down one early date in terms of dressing as crazy things,
right?
Which was 1745. King Louis XV of France had a masked ball at Versailles, and there were 15,000 guests. And everyone was in nice dresses and with masks, but he and several of his courtiers turned up dressed as clipped yew hedges.
Is that you?
And I think that's the year zero for dressing as stupid stuff.
And speaking of French fancy dress, do you know the Charles IV of France, the story of the Dance of the Burning Man?
No.
Burning Men, actually. This was a fancy dress party, and Charles IV and a load of his courtiers came dressed as savages, which meant they blacked up. And they covered themselves in pitch tar, and they chained themselves together. And then when they arrived at the party, one of the other guests wanted to have a good look at their costume. So he went up to them with a naked flame, and they were all wearing pitch tar.
Oh!
And they were all chained together, and they all went up. And I think two people were burned alive, two people died within days of their injuries. And it really, he was pretty mad to start off with, but that really tipped him over.
Wow.
Fancy dress is a dangerous game. Shouldn't do it.
Wow.
Americans got really into fancy dress in the 19th century, didn't they? And they would dress up as European aristocracy and wear. So it was like... I think the general consensus is, because people weren't really doing it in Europe, that America didn't really have at that time an aristocracy or a history of its own, in terms of, you know, it didn't have a great nobility, it didn't have all these big families, and so it kind of, what was the quote, is it bought its own history. And so people would buy, like, Marie Antoinette's genuine jewels and costumes and then go wearing them to parties, and you'd go to a party with, like, 1,200 guests, like the Vanderbilts used to hold these amazing parties in the late 19th century, and it would be a competition as to who had the most genuine artifacts that used to belong to a great British king or a great French ruler. Yeah, so it used to be a bigger deal than just buying a £10 plastic witch's costume from the local Scotland.
That's great.
Polar bears. Oh, yeah. Polar bears were in the original fact.
That's what yes, they were.
Yeah,
yes.
They dressed up as polar bears. Yeah. This is just because I discovered, coincidentally, last week, that pollution in the sea and in the seas at the poles is contaminating various wildlife there, and polar bears' penises are getting weaker. Their penis bones are being shrunken.
Well, they say that, but it is cold up there.
Yeah. They really don't need that extra excuse, do they?
It's getting warmer, though. And
oh, that's going, true. Yeah. So the female polar bears are going, it's getting warmer, but still nothing.
Well, Bob, where is it?
You've been promising me for 2 million years. And yet, it's the pollutants. That's what they claim. They don't know why polar bears have penis bones, but they are getting smaller, and they think it's going to do some kind of damage.
Most animals have penis bones, don't they?
No, they
yeah,
don't.
Yeah, we do.
Most of us on this panel. lots of animals have penis bones. Yeah, walruses. Yeah. And
like in the Victorian times, they wore badger penis bones as tie-pins.
Yeah. Oh, have you seen a walrus penis bone? No. I've held one. They're extraordinary.
Was it in the walrus at the time?
You felt...
When the walrus asks, just say no, Dan. Just say no.
I was at a fancy dress costume. This walrus. Okay. Hey, very quickly, this is just to bring it back to Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis died the same day as Aldous Huxley.
Hey.
We lost two literary juggernauts that day, and it kind of really didn't register with anyone because someone else died that day, JFK. And they just completely... No one actually knows they're dead yet, as a result. Yeah.
They're actually in the Guinness Book of Records for oldest writers. Yeah. Huxley and Lewis.
We need to move on, because we're really running past our time here. Okay, time for fact number 3, and that is Andrew Hunter Murray.
My fact is about Agatha Christie, and it's that Agatha Christie thought that Hercule Poirot, her most famous creation, was a, quotes, detestable, bombastic, tiresome, egocentric little creep. She hated him from quite early on as well in her career, and she wrote an essay called Why I Got Fed Up with Poirot, and she really, really didn't like him, and she wrote his death story in 1945, which was 30 years before she died, so she wanted to write it quite early, and she left instructions that when she died, that story should be published, so she would take him down with her. genuinely. And she even kept the manuscripts in a bank vault. That's how much she disliked Poirot's character. And then when she was 85, with her own health failing, she decided to publish it so that she would outlive him, I think. That's what I think she wanted to do. But when she did publish the story, Poirot got a front-page obituary in the New York Times, which wow. I think might be even more than she got. So
really?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't
know
whether she...
It's been a slow news day, isn't it?
Well, it's the only fictional obituary they've ever published.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so even in death, he was really, really famous, and she, you know, couldn't get her way to properly knock him on the head.
Was it front page of the obituary section?
Nope.
It was front page of that whole...
Of the paper. Yeah.
Jesus.
Wow.
Yeah. We say they're dumbing down today. That's
it is weird when you hear authors hating... They're central characters.
Yeah.
Like don't they? Like, who was Sherlock Holmes guy?
Yeah, Conan Doyle killed off Sherlock and then had to... Did you hear what chaos that created when he killed off Sherlock Holmes?
No, well.
I found a bunch of stuff. Basically, he just got... So he killed him off and then all these letters came in, which one began, "You brute!" Like, they just treated it as if it was real.
It's like the trolling of its day.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to write a letter to someone saying, "You brute."
Yeah. A lady picketed his house. Fans wore black armbands. 20,000 people cancelled their subscriptions to the Strand magazine, which it was being published as a periodical. And then I guess he eventually brought it back. But that must have been a confusing time for him, I guess.
So, A.A. Milne really hated Winnie the Pooh.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so cruel.
Everyone hated Winnie the Pooh, didn't they?
What?
All of his creators, A.A. Milne hated Winnie the Pooh. Christopher Robin.
He really
was so... I mean, his life was kind of ruined by the fact that he was Christopher Robin. He always resented I think that's
Wait, hang on. Was Christopher Robin A.M. Milne's son?
Yes. Resented that. And the guy who did the illustrations, who was, can't remember his name, but he said it, E.H. Shepherd, ruined his life as well, ruined his career. Everyone defined it by Winnie the Pooh.
Did they all have meetings where they're going, not this shit again?
If only we could stop doing it somehow.
Another thing that Milne hated about it was that it made people think that he liked children. And he said, I have never felt in the least sentimental about them.
Right.
So, but he did have a son.
Yeah, yeah. who was taking dictation when he was reading. Take a note. Tits are crap.
And he had a very difficult relationship with his son, it seems to be explained by this conversation.
So one thing you can do, if you really dislike your character, this is something Agatha Christie did. I love this. She put a version of herself in her own books, a mystery novelist called Ariadne Oliver, and in the novels that Agatha Christie wrote, this fictional novelist, Ariadne Oliver, hates her most famous creation, who is a vegetarian Finnish detective called Sven Hjersson, and she appears in 6 novels, this character who hates her main character. Oliver says, if I ever met that bony, gangling, vegetable-eating Finn in real life, I'd do a better murder than any I've ever invented.
That's a really good idea.
This is how much she disliked it.
It's a really good idea of putting yourself in novels, and then, and then the guy said, oh, easy jetter, idiots, aren't they? Everything that you're annoyed with, you can put in your book.
Another person who hates your own creation now is Annie Prue, who wrote Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Because of fan fiction. So she hates the fact now. So she was, nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. She wrote this brilliant short story, and she says she wished she'd never done it because she's plagued by fan fiction now, by people writing either sequels to Brokeback Mountain or alternative endings to Brokeback Mountain. And she said the vast majority of them are people who... So the majority of them are people who start their letters with, I'm not gay, but... and then go on to give an alternative ending where the two male characters end up together.
I've written an intense, searing, homoerotic series of... Yeah, yeah. And I've never written anything before in my life. And that's not the point of... Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Oh, yeah.
It's just every day a more homoerotic literature from people saying they're not gay.
But it does... There are, I think, more than 100 sequels to Pride and Prejudice. And obviously it's been 200 years, so there's a lot. But in one of them, Elizabeth Darcy, as she becomes, is widowed. Darcy is dead. And then she has to defend England from invasion by Napoleon in a fleet of hot air balloons.
Wow.
And I've never tracked down this book, but if I do, I am reading the hell out of it. It sounds so good.
We need to move on, guys, by the way. But if does anyone have anything else?
Nothing that's short enough.
Just one last thing, which is I really like when, as you're saying, Poirot goes on the front page of newspapers. I love it when these characters seep into the real world. And there's a thing I read that, which is the Met, and all crime departments in Britain, all the police, they use a national computer system, which is developed basically for major crime inquiries. All the British forces use it, and it's called the Home Office Large Major Inquiry System, but everyone refers to it by its acronym, HOMES. Is that quite nice?
Very nice.
And there, as well, is a training program for it called Elementary. Should we move on to our final?
Yeah.
Okay. Time for our final fact of the show, and that is my fact. So we've been talking about books this whole time, so I thought I'd find a fact which was about the enemy of the books, the television. So my fact is that before he invented the television, John Logie Baird invented a pair of socks to wear underneath your socks.
And who can say which history will judge the greater invention? I'm not calling it.
I love that fact because I just think that's, because if you look at the history of his inventions as well, prior to the television, he invented as well a razor which was rust-proof. You could never make it rust, but it never ended up selling because it was made of glass and it shattered on people's faces and ended up cutting it.
Okay.
Yeah, he made a glass razor.
It doesn't rust, but...
Yeah.
But it slices your face off.
But it cuts slices your face off, yeah. He made some pneumatic shoes that had balloons in them that thought...
they pull your feet off.
But just that's his history, and then suddenly the television. It just makes no sense.
But the socks were actually quite good, weren't they?
They were amazing.
Yeah, how did they work?
So they have... they're not designed to protect against moisture from the outside. It's the moisture that your feet create when you're walking around all day. So they were for soldiers in the First World War. And they're sprinkled with a chemical called borax, which absorbs the moisture from your foot. So you put it under your foot, facing upwards, as it were. You put it on that way. Then you put your sock over that, then your shoe over that. And soldiers in the trenches swore by it, and it made him a huge amount of money. It's what let him resign his job as an electrical engineer.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
One soldier said, "I find the bird under socks keep my feet in splendid condition out here in France. Foot trouble is one of our worst enemies, but thanks to the bird under sock, mine are in the pink."
Yeah, well, I hope you can just make an anti-German sock. My other worst enemy might also be...
It's true. That's rather, yeah, the worst enemy being foot trouble. Is...
That's a censored letter, I would say. In through the officers.
He advertised them in the newspaper and managed to sell one pair doing that. So initially it was a complete failure.
Right.
And then he built a plywood tank and carried it around the streets of Glasgow with the bed undersock written on the side. And then he sold loads.
Yeah. This was during the war, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, like, a big tank going through the streets of your town during a war.
People look
quite scary. So he made these socks, and then he got ill for a while, didn't he? And then when he got better, he suddenly realised he had loads of money in his account because people had bought all these socks.
Well, he went... That's what he was, didn't he go away?
Oh, gone away, yeah. But when he got all this money, he went to Trinidad, and he started up a jam factory. unfortunately, the local insect life either ran off with the sugar or landed in the hot vats of boiling preserve.
Wow.
Thing I read. And so it never took off because it was just insects, just full of insects. and so he lost a bit of money from that and then came back, and then it was when he invented the television.
But when he came back, before inventing the television, having had the sock business and
the razor,
the jam and the razor, he had 200 quid left. He was really broke. So he decided to buy 2 tons of Australian honey cheap and selling it to people. And then he bought a ton of soap and he sold that.
Wow.
Then television. Just complete out of nowhere.
No, to be fair, the television thing was something that he really dreamed about making quite early on, and he couldn't do it, so he had all these other businesses that went along the way.
So they were just kind of maybe a smokescreen, those other inventions, to throw people off the scent.
They absolutely were, in that, as well as when he would just make these other things. When he was making the TV, anytime he had a photo where he was showing how he was making the TV, he would put in fake objects so that no one who saw the photo could go, okay, so he's got that and got that. So he would misplace.
That's so cool. So it looks like he needs 2 tons of cheap Australian honey to get the TV to work. How has he done that?
Where do the socks go? I don't get it.
You were saying about the electricity. When he was working in Glasgow, he decided to try and make artificial diamonds by passing electricity through a stick of graphite. And he put so much electricity through the stick of graphite that he caused a blackout over the whole of Glasgow.
Wow.
There's a weird coincidence in his life as well. Just one of those tiny things that's actually, it's quite nice when you discover it. He went to school with a guy who was called, this was his classmate, his actual classmate. He went to school with a guy called J.C.W. Reith, who we now know as Lord Reith.
Well, really?
So basically, the inventor of the television went to school with the man who defined television for the BBC in England. That's an absolutely insane coincidence. And he got bullied by Lord Reith all the time. He just bullied the hell out of him. And Lord Reith's parents had to pull him out of school because he was just too much of a menace in that school.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Lord Reith was a bit of a...
He was a bully, yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And did John Lagerberg think, I'll get back at him, I'll invent something that's so good, he won't ever be able to take part in it?
He'll have nothing at it.
I cannot believe this is true, that originally, when the BBC sent out experimental transmissions, which was in 1929, that John Lagerberg had to pay the BBC to transmit his images.
Right.
Which is just so topsy-turvy.
Well, because, yeah, but like Lord Reef, for as much as he's done for TV, and if you haven't heard the name Lord Reef, in this country, most people have, I'm assuming, he's the guy who absolutely defined how the BBC became the thing that it is. He hated television.
Yeah, of course he did.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Wiener Baird invented it. His salary was £5,000 and a mean wedgie. just on authors' early inventions and early careers before they did the thing that we know them for, can I tell you very quickly about Daniel Defoe?
Yes, please. Mm-hmm.
Okay, his early jobs, and obviously Robinson Crusoe and the Journal of the Plague Year, all these incredible works. Before that, his early jobs included selling hosiery, dealing wine, investing in a diving bell to recover sunken treasure, and harvesting musk from the anal glands of cats.
Did she say hats?
No. No. It really happened. It was this. In 1692, he bought 70 civet cats for £850 because the Dutch made perfume using the musk, which they secrete as the base ingredient. And he hated them. And then to get the musk, an attendant had to put them in a special cage so they could only face one way. They couldn't turn around. And then, I'm quoting here, use a spatula to scrape out the butter-like secretion that gathered in a pouch between the tail and the anus. And then he lost the cats because he didn't even own them. He didn't pay for them properly. He got the money by borrowing it. And then to keep them, he defrauded his own mother-in-law, who then sued him like he was a disaster.
Wow.
But that was his, yeah.
So whose cat? They were just wandering cats?
No, they were owned by someone else, and he bought them with borrowed money, and then someone else said, no, I want my cats back. You can use them, but you don't own them.
And also, where's their anal butter? We've been stealing that.
I can't believe it's not civet cat anal butter.
We're going to have to wrap up. Okay, that's it. That's all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can all be gotten on Twitter. I'm on at Schreiberland. Andy.
At Andrew Hunter M.
James.
At Eggshaped.
Anna.
You can email podcast@qi.com.
And we will be back again next week. By the way, thank you so much for being here tonight, guys. This has been really fun. For those listening at home, we'll be back again next week with another episode. We'll see you then. Goodbye.